Hello, listeners, and welcome to the AfriWetu podcast, where we look to celebrate African history, people, and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibuni to any new listeners to the AfriWetu world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWetu episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we're headed to Southern Africa for part one of the Rotswe Empire. A shout out to my South Africans out there. AfriWetu is back on your borders. Now, I haven't said this in a while, but I feel the need that I need to say it now is that I do apologize profusely for the mispronunciation of words that will most definitely happen in the course of this episode. Before we begin, a very quick note, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWetu, where we do post interesting facts, stories, updates, and it would be great if you can interact with us and share with you some of your thoughts or stories. But for now, just sit back and enjoy the journey. We're ready with our maps, right? So, as we do so, open them up and let's find out where on our continent we shall land today. As I said before, we're in the southern region. And if you look over to the south central area, you will find modern day Zimbabwe. And between the Zambezi and Limpopo rivers, essentially that was what constituted the Rotswe Empire. In reality, though, its reach was much wider and influence felt beyond its borders to the southwest and left, i.e. towards Botswana, as well as, some people say, as far down south as southern Africa and all the way across to the east. So, as an intro, or to set some context, let's start with the name, Rotswe. Now, it has several different, explanations as into what it means. And one of them is that it's said to originate from the Shona word, Kurotsva, which comes from the present participle stem word of Rotswa, which is to churn, and has this verb synonym, synonym, paradza, which means to destroy in the most basic form. And then expanded, it is said to mean to unbuild, to pull or tear down, to separate into its constituent parts, basically to break up the structure and organic existence of, or to demolish. All of this very complicated stuff, it wasn't from my head. I used the Vashona Project Dictionary on vashona.com, so please check it out. So if we just unpack this rationale around the name just a little bit further, and it's worth it noting that on looking up the word, as I said before, many sources claim it is Shona for this to plunder, with an immediate affiliation with it being to use to describe the people. You see the name, the people, as a warrior group. However, that being said, there is a lot more nuance to this descriptor, and AfriWetu would love to hear from our Shona people, the fam, as to what this term means to them, what they've been told. And then from names to something that is also familiar, families. So when it comes to this particular empire, there were three main dynasties linked to it at various stages. The Mwenemutapa dynasty, we met them earlier in earlier AfriWetu episodes, season 1, episode 15, as part of the Kingdom Trilogy of Mapumbungwe. I know, now I know actually how to say it properly. Mapumbungwe, Mutapa, and Great Zimbabwe. And just on a quick side note, since that time, which is 5 years ago, people, I have learned a lot more about these kingdoms. And I just might go back for a deeper dive in later Afriwetu productions. So please remember to stay with us. Then we have the Torwa dynasty. And we speak of them, but very briefly, in this episode. And lastly, the most significant one in relation to this empire is the Changamire dynasty, which is the one which we'll have the most interaction with in the course of our journey through this empire. So moving from there, now is a good time to go to the origin story. Or should I say stories? Because one of the interesting things about the Rotsvi is its roots before the rise of Dombo. We'll get to meet him in a bit. And Afriwetu has discovered different variations along the way, with many linking to the wider Shona history. So in this section, we'll just take these factors into consideration and look at what are the most common threads across the different versions to give us a better sense of these ancestors. So to understand the Rotsvi Empire, one has to begin by understanding the older Mutapa kingdom that was led by Mwene Mutapa, whom we mentioned earlier. For this episode, we shall keep it brief just to give the context. It started in about the 14th century, around the time the Great Zimbabwe was nearing the end of its dominance, and the new leader in town, Mutota, his star was rising. He was expanding his own territory rapidly as he established his own empire, the Mutapa Empire. Mutapa had great influence and dominated the lands from its southern banks of the Zambezi towards the Kalahari and across to the east to modern-day Mozambique. It is from here that we see the emergence of the Rotsvi in the form of Changamire, and I'll say this early, Dombo Lakonga Chiwango, aka Dombo the First. He was an accomplished warrior leader, and it is said that he had close links with the Mutapas, in some versions as a relative from a lower rank, in others as a herdsman. Those are just two of them. We shall have a separate legends episode on him for sure, because his story is just so fascinating. But we shall still keep bumping into him as we explore this empire. It's also worth noting that he was not the first Changamire, just the most successful. In fact, his ancestors had in the late 15th and early 16th centuries already acted in rebellion against the Mutapas of the day, and between 1480s and 1540s, but they were eventually defeated by the 1500s, late 1540s, but that's a story for another day, and we are digressing. Anyway, in time, the mighty Mutapas had become beholden to European foreigners following a series of many events, unfortunate events, that then culminated in conflicts which saw two inflection points in the history that linked directly to this Rotsvi Empire. For one, you had the people who fled and settled down south, and then there was a rebellion by the people in about 1663 of these Mutapas who they saw as bought and had sold them out. And they then rallied around a particular Mutapa, Mutapa Mukombwe, who had started the Reformation, and he and his successors started to push back on the foreigners who had come to their lands. It is within this time that some claim the Varotsvi emerged. And then in 1684, Changamire is said to have led an army that defeated the Mutapas of the day, and the formation of the Rotsvi state really begun. They then were able to subdue the mighty kingdom and its tributaries. Some claim that this force then got them the name Rotsvi because they had disturbed the lives of all. Remember the Vashona explanation as into what Rotsvi meant. Now, Changamire had an ambitious expansion plan, and he became a powerhouse in the region, having conquered the lands with his armies, taking lands that were linked to lucrative trade from their minerals to the fertile areas. One of his famed conquests was the charge against the Torwa, which was the Butwa state in Mbire. It was in the south central southwest area, and it was a kingdom that had been dominant for about 200 years between the 15th and the 17th century. So it was no small feat to defeat them. And between the Torwa and Changamire dynasties, they covered the most southerly part of the region, with the former being in charge of lands filled with gold. The Torwa had actually been allies and had helped in curbing the Mutapa's influence. Oh, how times changed. Butwa, their lands, were taken from them by their old allies in the late 1680s, and by the 1690s, all their people had been assimilated. Changamire just kept on going from strength to strength, and with this and other conquests, gaining power and becoming one of the most dominant forces in Southeast Central Africa. I will say again, there are so many ways to have cut the origin of the Rotsvi, and if it sounds confusing, not to worry, it was such a task to piece it together from the very many different varieties. So again, Afriwatu from the region, please share with us your stories from your ancestors, and we will happily share them. In fact, if you could send a voice note on our platform, that would be even better, because again, you'd probably be doing a much better job with the pronunciations. Now, just briefly before we go into governance, the story of the Rotsvi dynasties is something which is worth just touching on here. And much like the origins, these are also closely linked to the Mutapa state. There's not enough time to really dig into the many layers, so we'll just do a very summarized version that really just helps in sort of like underlying the origin story we just heard. So going back to the version which states that Changamire came from the royal homestead, and where Changamire the First was granted his own territories to govern in the southern area by Mwene Mutapa the Second, who at the same time also granted territory to Torwa, the other dynasty. Changamire then, upon establishing himself and raising a very well-trained and fierce and disciplined army, declared independence. He removed Mwene Mutapa in about 1490 and installed Mwene Mutapa's son, Mwene Mutapa the Fifth. In turn, because, you know, swings and roundabouts, Changamire was then killed by Mwene Mutapa's own successor, who was then later beaten by Changamire's son, Changamire the Second, who's most commonly known as Dombo, through a long and protracted war. I hope we're still together. This Changamire then went on to expand the territory even more, and the Changamire dynasty was born. Dominance was set by them over the region from the 1700s, and future successors were then given a new title, Mambo. It was then from the 18th century onwards that other ruling houses grew from the chiefdoms in the area. The dynasties that could point to a direct correlation or strongly linked and influenced from the Rotsvi included the Mavutsi, the Singo, the Nambia, the Shangwe, just to name a few. They can be found spread from northwest right over to the southwest areas. So right, now let's look at the governance and how these dynasties and their courts ruled. The Rotsvi Empire's governance system followed initially a loose centralized approach when it came to the very, very beginning. In fact, the earlier rulers were always on the move and in expansion mode, so as they looked to continue conquering territory. This didn't really lend well to a very regular or systemized way to receive tribute in neither time nor place. Tribute initially was given as and when there was an event such as a coronation or a ceremony that required the tributary chiefs to attend. This continued to be the case within up until the 17th century, by which time there was a central base from whence the empire's administration and officials operated. Over the course of this transition, one thing that never changed was the highest position in the land, and that was the Mambo, the overall ruler. He had both executive and legislative powers, and he was basically the most powerful person in the lands. The Mambo was a hereditary title based upon a patriarchal Adelphic system. Yep, I learned this term during the course of this research. It basically means it moved from brother to brother. With the Rotswe, it played out a little bit like this. The Mambo who rose to the throne was the son of the eldest brother, the nephew, and upon his death, the title was passed on to the next brother's son, so basically his own nephew, and so on and so forth. This doesn't mean to say that it was neat and tidy in a bow and it was just a given. Actually, there were times when the Mambo succeeded by his own son and not his nephew, but this, it seems, was pretty rare. There was actually a system in place to avoid succession conflicts. There was this thing of which was a caretaker role, which was constitutionally recognized, and it was part of the institution. So what was this provision, I hear you ask? Well, when there was a gap between the old Mambo and the new one, and for whatever reason the new one was not in place, then the Tumbare dynasty, who were the military clan as well as holding the high rank administratively and were also in charge of tributes and the empire's coffers and wealth, would have their head of the clan, which is also a hereditary role, sit on the throne as an interim ruler, basically as the regent. This dynasty was part of the royal clans and was the second most powerful, so it wasn't something that would have been disputed. Then by having this caretaker role, what it meant was that behind the scenes, without disrupting the governance of the empire, the potential and competing heirs and the nobility could negotiate and fight without the risk of that conflict spilling into and over to disrupt everything. Once all of that was done and there was a Mambo in place, there was a constitutional infrastructure that supported his role and the governance of the lands. One of the key bodies was the Dare of the Magotas, the councillors. The Magota were the next level of governance, and they were very influential. Many of the Magota roles were hereditary, and they were filled by representatives from the different royal houses, with key positions granted to specific noble families and political dynasties. The holders represented families from the military to the spiritual leaders of the empire and everything in between. The Dare, where they sat, was a powerful body and key in the empire's running. They acted as a check on the Mambo to make sure he didn't overstep his authority. It was in his interest to get their advice, consideration, and support for any of his major decisions. The next level from that were the appointed regional provincial governors. Those two always get me confused. Who then sat in different seats across the empire. They were appointed by the Mambo and owed their allegiance to him. They ran the provinces and ensured that the Mambo's hold and control was felt by their leadership. We should look at the provinces in a few, but first let's just round up with one more aspect of governance and control. The Mambo's government would collect tributes from their lands, and this came in the form of goods such as livestock, ivory, gold and beads, iron goods and such like. This would then be led, it is said, by the military, who were part of the administration, and the general, who was the most senior level of the administration. Tribute was viewed as a confirmation of allegiance to the empire, so any refusal or resistance to pay it was met by swift military action, whether by force or a friendly visit. It was that serious. Right, so now let's take a closer look at the provincial systems before we close up this episode. Cool? So the Rotswe leadership used the existing structures across the empire to manage the provinces, alongside rewarding their own loyalists with chieftainships. These existing structures included reinstating, and I do that with sort of like commas, basically reinstating the hereditary chief systems. So the Mambos didn't take away the chief in the area, right, that they conquered. Instead, they would make them go through a swearing-in ceremony, the Kugadza Ishe. And at this ceremony, the new chief would be handed the instruments of power and dressed to reflect this with royal robes of sheepskin. It is at the ceremony that they would then have to declare their allegiance to the Mambo, and that was the requirement in order to respect Rotsvi customary laws and report regularly to central government. Chiefs would go through this in order to be legitimized, regardless of their own right to rule, and they would have had to have gone through to get the blessing of the Mambo in person or through his high-level proxy. The ceremony was actually a really clever political tool to control the regions and the provinces, as it forced them to get formal approval from the Rotsvi, the central Rotsvi government. This was a practice that went on for centuries. Those who were political appointees in terms of chiefs, they were just pure loyalists, and this was their reward for their existing allegiance. The chief installation ceremonies had a lot of symbolism and regalia, so I think this is best explained when we actually just take a trip back and join in to witness one of them. We find ourselves in the middle of a town in full-blown celebration. The installation of a new chief will be taking place. We must rush and get to the event to witness the swearing-in. Our guide ushers us to our place. We are privileged to be among the honored guests. Afriwetu knows people. Anyway, we settle in and we wait. Next, we see a great entourage coming in. The incoming chief is surrounded by his people, dripping wet. I mean, there's a river nearby, but still, it is certainly quite odd. However, nobody seems particularly bothered, nor surprised. Anyway, what we can feel is the sheer excitement of the ceremony. You can feel the high. In the middle of the court, there is a feast. Food and drink in abundance. And on closer inspection, the centerpiece looks a lot like, oh wow, it's a crocodile. What a sight. Okay, we definitely need to come back to that for an explanation, but things are moving really fast. And we look around and we hear some noise and we see another entourage is present. Reserved, but they stand out because they're not joining in the revelry and they seem to be more observant and quite regal in how they're standing. There are two men in particular who catch our attention. One looks like serious royalty just from his clothes and stature and the way those around him show him a certain level of deference, and the other, who seemed to be more animated, was clearly in charge. A hush falls in. The ceremony is about to begin. The first thing that is brought out is a rope. Yep, a rope. And then it is handed to those royal-looking men in that second entourage, whom we then heard referred to as the Rotsvi representative. Ah, okay, that makes sense. Then the other man, the one who's more animated, turns out he's a priest, a Mafutsi. He then calls out and we see the servants bring out the ceremonial and installation regalia. He then starts his speeches and the ceremony officially begins. The priest tells the gathering that the new chief has followed the installation rites. He has been submerged in the nearby river, purified for this new role that he was going to take on. Ah, that explains the drenched man. And now that he was cleansed, he would be clothed in befitting robes of his new chiefdom. And so he's called to come forward. He's then robed in a black and white cloak. It's called the Fuko. He's then crowned with a royal feathered headdress, the Chiremba. In some cases, we hear this could also be a flat piece of iron, which is called a parimwe. Once he's in full view of the gathering, the proceedings continue with the history of these regalia told to us. He then has a ndoro pinned to his chest. There's a short pause, we all start chatting, and then another hush falls as the next part begins. We see ceremonial artifacts brought out. These are the instruments of power. The priest takes each one, and as happens in these times, he's about to hand them over to the new chief. He starts with the Asegai, and then the Maparimwi, a black and brass axe designed for fighting to protect his people. And then he's given an iron scepter and bows and sheaths of arrows. The symbolism of being a protector is everywhere. At each stage, the priest holds up the item and speaks of their importance and symbolism, informing the new chief that these were powerful artifacts of rule and chiefdom, and they were handed down from one chief to the next. They are serious heirlooms. As you can see, said one of the new chief's representatives, our new leader is brave, strong, and skilled. See what we feast on. This crocodile he hunted and killed. He has eaten of this beast and taken on its nature and the power to speak to the other world through the medium of water after all of the initiation ceremonies. Now all of you bow down to his rule, a rule that has been granted by the ancestors and made possible by the Rotsvi Mambu, who has sent his representative who will perform the final rites. Chief, come forward. Come forward. Today, you have been crowned with a new name. Our guide whispers to us and tells us that all the new chiefs in this area who are loyal to the Rotsvi would change their praise names to Rotsvi ones. The name he picks has pleased the representative, who proceeds to tie the rope he has to the new chief. This rope is a symbol of the link your chief has to the empire, the chief and you, the people. Long may his reign be, says the representative. Then he declares, you, chief, are now the ruler. Look after the people. I give them to your care. And with that, let's leave our Rotsvi here for today. Let's leave them partying and look what else was happening in the world before we close up part one of this empire. So, starting in 1666 was the Great Fire of London. 1672 to 1676 was the Polish-Ottoman War. In 1690 was the Battle of Boyne in Ireland. And 1692 to 1694 was a famine in France that killed 2 million people. So, to bring it home, let's finish off with a chuckle moment, because why not? In the study of this empire, it is claimed that the term Rotsvi was created by the Portuguese in the 18th century, and it is in fact they who baptized the empire and the people with this name. If you recall at the start of this episode, we spoke of the root of the name partly being in Shona and other various things. Fact, it was there before the 18th century. Fact, it is not the Europeans who created them. But anyway, there you go. Alternative facts are always very interesting to hear, no? So there are a number of things that made it such a great empire to explore. And before you ask, yes, this will be one of the three-part civilizations for sure. So get settled in for two more visits to these great, great ancestors. And remember, to come back and also remember to go and do your own deeper research. But until next time, Mubarak Iwe!